podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The Bishop and the Bear, the Bishop and the Bear, and to the delight of everyone, they are here to share jokes and rants and guests and things. Who knows what any fun they'll bring?
Not affiliated with the Mad Bishop and Bear pub at Paddington Station.
The Bishop and the Bear, bats beyond compare. Buckets of savoir faire, the Bishop and the Bear.
Salog willkommen til Biskups og Bjorns. Now that, actually, I believe, if Google Translate is to be trusted, means hello and welcome to the Bishop and Bear, but in Icelandic. Now there's a reason. It doesn't. I've already fallen at the first hurdle. Blame Google Translate. That's what it says. I'm literally reading it word for word on Google Translate. Somebody laughing at the bar on our bar stool of bravado with the bear and I is author, editor of Wisden, Kit Harris, who has written an extraordinary book called From Lords to the Fjords. It's the saga of Icelandic cricket, and we thought, what a great opportunity to get Kit on, or Kato, as we tend to know him, but there is a reason for that, to talk about that. And so that's what we're going to start off with. We're going to cover plenty of other good stuff as well. We're going to try and find out a little sneak preview of what to look out for in Wisden, which comes out in April. Obviously, we'll talk about India, the upcoming game in Dharamsala. Interesting comments about spin and how they should get more games for Hartley and Shoaib, and I think that would be great, but can it ever happen? What is up with Ollie Robinson's hair, and indeed the rest of him? An Australia-New Zealand series where New Zealand are doing their usual New Zealand thing. So there's plenty to chat about. But first of all, Kit, warm welcome to the Bishop of Bear. What can I get you to drink? What would be a good Icelandic drink?
They're very boring when it comes to drink. They would have Egilsgut,
which is
a golden lager. Yeah. From the Egil Brewery.
Oh, okay.
Is that any good?
Well, I'm teetotal for 25 years, so I've got a clue.
So, on received advice.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll put that next to you. What would you
do?
A soft drink of some kind that you can have along the way. We'll get you a diet coke. Is that good enough?
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Right. So my first question was obviously going to be about you, the book, and how you came to this fantastic association with Iceland, as indeed we have a little bit. But because you sniggered so unkindly at my brilliant translation. What did I now need mean? To know what the fuck was wrong with it?
Do yours again.
Okay. It was Sal og Vilkommen til Biskups og Bjorns.
Oh, right. Yes, I see. Yes, okay, it's not. Yes. You said it so badly the first time round.
thanks for that.
So what you're trying to say is
hello and welcome.
Sight.
Yeah.
Cyclo willkommen.
Willkommen.
Frau Biskups Objörn.
Frau Biskups. Is it Ogbjorn?
Ogbjorn.
Even though it's got a G in it. Ogbjorn.
Yeah.
Willkommen, that sounds German.
It does. Or Dutch.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a link there.
It's
well.
Willkommen.
Okay. To any aspirant broadcasters out there who would like to do things properly rather than the way we do it, don't rely on Google Translate.
But everyone relies on Google Translate.
It's obviously utter bollocks.
Well, of course it is. That's how I communicate with the French when I'm over in France.
Anyway, look, I have to tell you, I only got this book in my hands last night because I came to the book launch, the Nightwatch book launch, which was a great event in itself. I did get about three chapters in. And I ended up chatting with a lovely lady called Beverly on the train, which rather distracted me. But she was really taken with it. So we had quite a long chat about Icelandic cricket and what we knew. And I did say to her that we had actually covered an Iceland game against the MCC in Bushy Park. So I told her that little story. She was transfixed and fascinated by it and couldn't wait for me to get off when I got to play it.
I was going to say, who's this strange old man talking to me?
But a couple of, less of the old, thank you very much. I'll settle for strange. Kit, so let's start, because it is a fascinating read of what I've got through. Let's start with you. And just tell us a little bit about this association that you have so closely with A, Iceland and B, Icelandic cricket. How did that all come about?
Well, my name, Keito, is Icelandic because my mother was completely obsessed with the Norse and Iceland, despite never in her life having been to Iceland. I took a different route academically. I became a glaciologist. So I started visiting Iceland regularly. And when I was in a lull, employment-wise, in about, when would that, 2017, I decided that I would go to Iceland and start a travel company there. And while I was there, I thought I must try and start the Iceland cricket team, which was a bit conceited as an instinct, because it turned out that it already existed and had been created by a group of Icelandic students, now men in their 40s, for a joke about 20 years previously, and was now flourishing.
Wow.
So did you help them push on then?
Yes. When I sort of tentatively got involved, it had started to be run by expats and become a bit more serious than the joke team that had been started by the Icelandic, the natives, the students. But they were they had got themselves into a bit of a rut, especially in terms of administration and management and finance. And I said, well, I've just started getting involved in cricket broadcasting because I just started commentating for the BBC now and then, having commentated for Guerrilla Cricket for a while. You were my springboard into doing that, as we know. And, I've made a couple of sort of punts, starting Iceland cricket on Twitter and that sort of thing, and it just absolutely exploded. People were captivated by the idea of supporting the world's weakest cricket team, most obscure cricket team, and it all took off about 2018, 2019.
Social media sensation. As you mentioned, we got to cover a game against the MCC in beautiful Bushy Park, did a live broadcast, live coverage, and they didn't get thumped. They did not get thumped, I said. They held their end up, although they did lose. Now, a lot of the story of the book, because it actually delves quite deep into this the history that is related in Iceland through the sagas. And that comes up with some extraordinary things. But the first thing I sort of wanted to ask you about, Keito, was Ragnar Kristjánsson, who is very much a central character in the story. I found this great quote. They should make a statue of Ragnar and put it outside Parliament. People should walk out of Parliament and be able to see a statue of Ragnar. And then almost as an afterthought is added, on a horse.
Yeah.
But it was by a Stebbi Admundsson, who I have no idea, sadly, who he is. So tell us a little bit about Ragnar. Why is he so central to from Lords to the Fjords?
Ragnar is the key figure in beginning cricket in Iceland. I mean, usually in small cricket-playing countries where it's just started, some hugely enthusiastic cricket-mad expat comes along. He's in a bar with other expats, and they know how it goes. They're usually English or Australian or Indian or Pakistani, and they start chatting and they start the cricket team. Well, that's not what happened in Iceland. It's almost unique in world cricket. You've got this guy living on an island off the south coast who has nothing to do all day except go to work in a local school and come home and watch Sky Sports News, and he's very keen on football, but every now and then, they show a little tiny clip for 30 seconds of what he thought looked like men in suits standing about in a field.
Right.
He didn't know there's no other information about this game, but he thought this game looks very civilized and very, very, very easy and relaxed. We should have an Iceland team doing whatever it is they're doing. And who's to say if I can't get 10 other people or however many people are in the team, obviously he didn't know that either, then we should be able to enter an Olympic team and I can play for Iceland in the Olympics.
I like his logic.
There is one flaw in that argument, of course, at the time, but
he probably didn't know that, though, did he?
We can gloss over that.
It's surprising the number of years it took for him to work out that the Olympics thing wasn't going to happen. but he did create the Iceland national team.
Fantastic.
What he didn't expect was for there to be such interest. But he got his little team together and they called themselves Iceland. But he made a colossal mistake of contacting the European arm of the ICC, which was then called the European Cricket Council, and getting Iceland cricket the contacts of Iceland Cricket Association put on their website. So there was suddenly this stream of interest from overseas. Can we come and tour? Can we send a coach? Even as the book recounts, Sky Sports saying, a cricket team in Iceland, well, can we come?
Well, they were going to turn up for the Icelandic Cup final, weren't they? Sky Sports, and then the Iceland guys panicked and went, hang on, we better actually stage one.
Ragnar felt that he didn't ever want to disappoint anyone. So if someone phoned up and said, do you have a team? Yes, we have two teams and they play each other regularly and so forth. So he blagged and, well, he lied. He lied and lied and lied. So when Sky Sports said, you tell us a bit. And he said, well, just off the top of his head, he decided to say, oh, well, on Saturday we have the Icelandic Cricket Cup final, as it happens. They said, that's wonderful news, we're going to send a crew over to film it. He had 4 days to find two teams to play cricket when he only had about six regular players at this, well, six once a year players at this point. He had 4 days to try and put two teams on the park, all appropriately dressed, for Sky Sports to come over and film it. I mean, talk about cool runnings. I mean, this is just crazy stuff.
Who won?
It didn't happen, did it?
No, it did happen, yes.
No, it did happen.
Everything he claimed, he managed to fake for the cameras when they came over. It snowballed and it snowballed. And in the end, you've got, a new airline launching through a cricket match at midnight with Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden.
I was going to ask about how Iron Maiden got involved, but you've jumped into that. So tell us, how does Bruce Dickinson fly into the story at some point?
A new airline, Iceland Express, one of the sort of, what do they call, no-frills airline, launched. And for some reason, their publicity person thought the best way to promote an airline that links Iceland with England would be to have a cricket match at midnight, brought over this flight load of English celebrities, Henry Blofeld and Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden, who's an airline pilot, flew the first Iceland Express flight. Then they came over and played the Iceland national team, beat them obviously, as everybody did. And the whole thing just became this totally unwieldy, out of hand experience for all these Icelanders who were just trying to have a little bit of cricket in the park, that they fleetingly found themselves the world's attention. I mean, the ICC said that the vast majority of all inquiries they got about ICC Europe were about an Iceland cricket team.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's a fantastic story. Now, I mean, there is, whilst it's as far as I got with Beverly's distraction on the train back to Claygate last night, it's incredibly amusing and very written with a sort of a nice, lovely, light touch, there is a real thread of interesting history in there where you sort of trawl the old Icelandic sagas and discovered, I think, a game called, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but it's Knattleikr.
Oh, that was very good.
Oh, well, good. It's better than my Welcome to the Bishop of Bear in Iceland, so that's at least something, I suppose. I mean, a lot of people tend to zoom in on this chap John Derek in 1598, who mentioned that he used to play cricket years ago, right? But this was, we're going back to the 9th century, and you found some sort of game between Mirar and Borg. And you make an extremely good argument that there were huge elements of this game, Knattleikr, which were similar to cricket. The only difference is it had elements of death and vomiting thrown in, which is quite a problem.
That's a bit different.
Which is, you know, which is more akin perhaps to a Chelsea Leeds semi-final in the 1970s than it is to cricket. But tell us about how this association and the sagas, because it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, everyone's got a little bit of an interest, haven't they, in you know, where cricket came from. And, you know, in terms of the British Isles, yeah, we know this guy, John Derrick, in a court case in Guildford in the 16th century. It was, you know, referred to that cricket had taken place in his youth. Or, you know, I forget which century it is now. It's in the book. And there are some suggestions that a similar sport was being played in Flanders. But we don't really have an ancestor for cricket. Well, the Vikings, the sagas are very, very detailed. And the Vikings did play this game, Knattleikr, the ball game, as it translates. And
very literal.
That's how Norse is.
Right.
It's a literal description of everything. So there was a bat and ball game. The bat is called the Knattrea, which means the ball tree.
Right.
And if you go through all the, there's 15 references in the sagas to Knattleikr, and if you go through every reference, gleaning what you can, you can make about sort of 20 observations about the game, and 18 of them are basically cricket. You have a bat, it's one on one. You have one person with a bat, one person with a ball. The ball hurler throws the ball at the person with the bat, who has to try and hit it. There's a boundary, and if the ball goes over the boundary, it's particularly humiliating for the ball thrower. There's so many similarities to cricket. And I guess my honest point, once you take the humour aside, is if you're looking for a game that's the ancestor of cricket, it's the best candidate available to you. And I rather more whimsically propose in the book a mechanism for getting the game from Iceland to this supposed Flanders appearance in the 14th century. I didn't realise, I sort of rattled the cages of one or two gatekeepers of sport history who say, oh, well, you know, this is very unconvincing, you know, this is very unlikely. But when I say, oh, you know, well, how, to these experts, in what way is it unconvincing? These great academics of sport say things like, well, the Vikings aren't very crickety, are they? Which strike me as a particularly effective rebuttal. But, you know, I've laid out in the book a case for this is the ancestor of cricket. So if that doesn't win a prize, I think nothing will.
In the book I found that you've got a list of, I think, 14 similarities with cricket and a few that potentially you're very honest and say don't quite add up, like the games played on a frozen lake. There's no scoring system, and intimidation's a vital ingredient. Well, actually, there is a bit of it. I don't necessarily agree that that's an argument against. If you
intimidation? Well,
no,
you know, Thompson.
Intimidation is definitely possible.
West Indies pass bowling attack.
Yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. The death and vomiting actually happens. I mean, one bit that fascinated me was, you talked about the bat and the ball. If you smacked the ball high back over the head of the person that threw it at you, there was every chance that you might get your head cleaved in with an axe, and that actually did happen. I probably paraphrase that really, really badly, but there is somewhere in the story, in the book, I recall a head cleaving. So tell us a bit about how that fitted into it.
Yeah, there are axes, there are cleaving, but that is not part of the game. I mean, the references to the game are always to advance the story of the saga. So it's never a description of the game in itself. So I guess what you're reading about in the sagas are, in particular, the games that go wrong, or the games that there's a game that ends up with the king being assassinated, or there's a game that ends up with the queen being seduced, and so forth. And one of the two more famous saga heroes, one is Njál, I suppose, but Egil Skallagrimsson, is the great Icelandic anti-hero, an incredibly, incredibly violent man who, you know, shags and vomits and murders his way around Iceland. But it's the first reference. All the sagas are datable. So this is 911 AD. Aegil is, what is he? He's probably about, he's 6, 7, or 8 years old, and he's allowed to play his first game of Knattleikr. But he's not mature enough to take the game as a serious show of strength. So when he gets bested in the game by a teenager called Grim, he gets very upset and goes off, storms off, and gets an axe and cuts Grim's head off.
Nice.
But it is pointed out in the saga.
This might be a couple of ICC demerit points.
This is not the done thing. You're supposed to show that you're stronger than your opponent till all the spectators agree who's best. The murder is not, it's not supposed to be part of it, I hasten to add. Vikings weren't interested in things like points.
No.
They're interested in who's the strongest. Points are what, none of our great games used to be about points. It's the English who come along in the 19th century and codify everything so that it has rules. I mean, how very English, introducing leg byes and getting rid of all the sort of bloody noses.
Yeah, very, very English.
there's some other interesting stories. One I know which is going to fascinate the bear, who's long held the opinion that as a left arm spinner, you could still go for less than 8 and over in the IPL.
Yep.
I think it was actually you, under the name of Cato Johnson, who somehow ended up as a mystery spinner. Or was it King's 11 Punjab?
That's right.
Yes. Now, how did an Icelandic mystery spinner, i.e. you, end up netting with King's 11 Punjab?
This was when the Iceland cricket Twitter phenomenon happened about 2019, when everything suddenly went crazy. I mean, they've got, what have they got now, 128,000 followers on Twitter. This explosion of this world's tiniest team with a bigger Twitter following than any team in the world other than the 12 test playing nations. And King's 11 Punjab had this idea that they wanted to play. You know how much money these teams have got, right? These franchises. I mean, incredibly wealthy.
And they're sharing it all around the world.
They are. It's wonderful, isn't it? Their management got this idea that they wanted to play a joke on the squad for April Fool's Day. This joke involved bringing over a mystery spinner from the world's tiniest cricketing nation. And they said, will you come over and do this? And, be Icelandic and get introduced to the squad. So, as it happens, I am a spin bowler and I do tend to bowl this ball called the backspinner, which is fallen out of fashion. It was very Victorians used to bowl it a lot. So I suppose, my action is hardly mystery, but it's, the ball is an unusual ball to bowl and it's got, many, many wickets over at club cricket level over the years. So I went over there and I was put into the kit and brought in, and the players were told this is the new mystery spinner from Iceland. And one batter in the team called Prab Simran Singh, who now he scored his first IPL 100 in the last season, I think. But at the time, he was very much the junior, and he was told, make this guy look good. So
that's part of the joke. That's part of the joke. Okay.
Well, on my day, I might have been able to bowl, a succession of, at the very least, good length balls at him, but I just got off 3 flights to get to Chandigarh. I hadn't had any chance to warm up. So, my first ball to this guy is a sort of, I can't remember which came first, the massive long hop or the full tops.
You varied it. You mixed it up for him.
Those were definitely the first 2 balls. He'd been told, don't. So he sort of bunted it back and took one hand off the glove. Just as I was about to say, give me 2 balls to warm up, Mike Hessen, the coach, stormed over and said, oh my God, we can use this. Mujib Zadran and David Miller then come over to the net and like, hang on a minute, what's going on here? So then comes my other rank ball. And after 2 balls, I'd probably settled into a little rhythm of at least, thoroughly untesting on a length. But by this time, Hessen's gone over to the camera crew and saying, well, this is absolutely outstanding. And as soon as Hessen's back is turned, perhaps Simran can bear it no longer. So while this interview is going on, you know, you just see this wiry, 40-year-old supposed Icelandic spinner being spanked to kingdom come by a 17-year-old in the IPL net. Well, you know, Mujeeb Zadran and Sam Curran stand sort of, you know, scratching their heads like, okay, what the fuck is going on? Let's just say it doesn't take very long for the penny to drop among the players.
Yes.
Right, okay.
But having got me there, Kings 11 Punjab thought, well, yeah, that was fun, but we've got him here now, so let's tell the Indian press that we have signed him and he is going to play against Delhi Capitals tonight. And he's going to open the bowling and he's going to play in place of Murugan Ashwin. So they have me signing autographs at the Lalit Hotel and, you know, showing Ravi Chandran Ashwin, who's the captain, how to bowl the backspin. I mean, apart from anything else, you know.
But Ravi, R. Ashwin was presumably in on the joke, Kit, though, wasn't he? Or was he not being fooled along with everyone else?
He was, but he was a bit more sort of distant from the joke because, you know, he's very busy, very much in demand. And, yeah. You know, R. Ashwin is, you know, he's a very, you know, he's what a thinker about the game he is all the time, you know. But I did, you know, I just show him how to bowl this ball and he said, well, okay, I'm going to bowl it first ball in the match.
Fantastic.
And, he got a wicket first ball of the game with my backspinner.
Nice. No way. Wow.
Well, I hasten to add, this was his version of my backspinner.
Well, he probably took the raw material and improved on it.
Exactly.
A tiny bit. There we go.
But, you know, it's apart from anything else, it's a good chapter in the book.
Well, It is. The book, I should remind everybody, in case you, for some strange reason, wandered into the pub halfway through, From Laws to the Fjords, it's the saga of Icelandic cricket. It's the extraordinary story of how Iceland cricket came to be such a phenomenon on social media and indeed in reality. But it's part history. It's very funny, but there's that grain of historical truth that Kit's built into all of it, and it is an absolutely fascinating. There's a foundation of historical truth based on the sagas.
Not a word of historical inaccuracy.
No. It talks about Kanatlika how that effectively was cricket, and it was played back in the 9th century. It is published by Fairfield, and you can find it at, well,
all good bookstores, all good, and probably Amazon.
Indeed.
Afraid so.
Yes. From Lords to the Fjords is the book to look out for. It's by our friend Kit Harris, and I can tell you, I shall be finishing reading it, and where I got to before the lovely Beverly kind of interrupted me on my train journey home has been rattlingly good and well worth the read. So while we've got you, we're just going to carry on and chat. Tell us a little bit, of what you can. What are we looking out for? It's not that long until the almanac comes out in April, isn't it? So we're only a month or so away. What can we be looking out for there?
Well, the Wisden Cricketers Almanac, of which I have the immense joy and privilege of being the assistant editor, we put it to press at the end of last week, and it's published on Thursday, the 20th of April, if I'm right in saying. So all the usual stuff is there. There are one or two bits that I can trail for you. We introduced in 2023 the Wisden Trophy for the best test performance. And that went, of course, to Johnny Bairstow last year for his twin centuries against India. So there's this extra new award, almost new award to announce. But what we also did, which was probably just about the most fun thing we did at Wisden Towers over the year was we decided we must backdate the Wisden Trophy for all the years of Test cricket, and we broke it into two sections. So this year we have the post-war Wisden Trophy allocation, and that's a good pub table night long task, isn't it? Okay, right. Ooh, 1960, here are all the good performances. Who do we give it to? That really was fun to do. So we unveil all the post-war Wisden Trophy.
How many years do you go back? Or everything post-war, or even before the war?
If you buy 2023, if you haven't already, still available on the Bloomsbury website, okay. You can read 1877 to the war. So you've got the first set there. 1877 is... there's probably no surprise there, given what happened in the first Test match.
Yes,
but that's good fun to finish off that thread.
So Bannerman. Did Bannerman get your first Wisden Test award? Basically, possibly makes sense.
How could he not?
No.
I'm sure that certain years like 1956 will not be altogether surprising in the new Wisden, but there
Jim Laker, I guess.
Plenty of, plenty of obvious candidates and one or two, I'd forgotten about that sort of surprises. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is an award that can be won by a men's or women's test performance.
But it's the performance, it's not the whole year.
One test match.
Wow.
Now, what else have we got? You would expect us to have really good writing, as we do, on the wonderful Ashes series that we had last year. So we have Gideon Haig, of all people, on the Ashes series. So that will be a good read. And we have the tributes. I don't think it's any great spoiler to say we have really comprehensive tributes to Stuart Broad and... Catherine Sibber-Brunt and Anya Shrubsall, who all retired in 2023. But yeah, if it happened, it's in there.
Cool. And it comes out in April. Is there a date in April you can give us?
April the 20th. And I should say, because it's if you're a naughty Amazon user, it's not altogether obvious that there is a very, very smart way of getting the £60 Wisden at half price. Which is if you go to Wisden's home site, if you search for Wisden Cricketers Almanac, or go to wisdenalmanac.com, or just to search it through bloomsbury.com, our publisher, you can get Wisden for half price by the simple expedient of subscribing to it, which means you get it every year and various other little perks. But you get it for 30 rather than 60, which must be one of the better discount deals in the cricket world.
Indeed. Wow. Okay. Well, we'll look out for that.
Guess we get onto some cricket now.
Well, I was about to say. Well, we've been talking cricket. We're talking Icelandic cricket and historical cricket. What have you made of the Test series so far, Kit? From what you've seen, India. I'm talking in India and England.
Yeah. Tremendous. Thoroughly enjoyed it. There have been, I think they've probably been, well, we've been spoiled, haven't we, by Bazball? Because we have, our expectations have been changed. Our pre-India tour expectations in recent years are how badly are we going to lose this?
Yes.
And this year, it's, could Bazball win it? And I think that, if you take out a couple of batting collapses,
yes,
we had opportunities, eh?
Taking the bigger picture, I'm still very grateful that we're able to talk about this series from a disappointed England fans' point of view. From two batting collapses, away, and ruining those missed opportunities. Whereas in a previous series, that would have been a luxury.
Yeah.
Last time round, just it was not. Oh, if only we hadn't collapsed those two times. Last time round, it was. We have absolutely no answer to this guy Akshar Patel.
Yeah.
We barely heard of before the series.
Other than to find a couple of blokes with terrible figures in county cricket, but who at least are tall enough to look a bit like him. Hence we got Hartley and Shoaib Bashir.
The disappointment really is, isn't it, that the thing we thought wouldn't really, you know, would be our weakness, which is our spin attack, has actually performed really well. And the thing we hoped that would potentially make a difference to our first innings scores, the aggressive approach, hasn't really come off. But it's been, you know, you can't fault the quality of the cricket. I haven't moaned about the pitches once. I think we've had four really good and different cricket pitches. The first and fourth test matches have been good Indian cricket pitches with, you know, lots of spin, but a good batter will get good runs. As my God, this Yashasvi Jaiswal.
Yeah, what a talent, eh? He's already fourth. If you look at players whose highest averages in first class cricket have played over, I think, 100 games or 150 yep. games, he's fourth on that list.
No, that's what's his name? Safraz.
Jaiswal second. Safraz is fourth, that's right.
I mean, and I think, I mean, Shubman Gill, I wasn't really ever riding on the boat of questioning his place in the team. I think he's going to be absolutely class for years to come. And very possibly, Safraz Khan may, if he remains fit, because, you know, he's a big lad in a very fit world, but I think Safraz Khan could top them all, actually. He's a phenomenal player.
Yeah, and he certainly has a huge track record of runs in the Ranji Trophy, and, you know, it's taken him best part of 10 years to get into the team, I think.
he was a bit ropey in the last test, though, wasn't he? When the pressure was on, he didn't really show it. So, I mean, he did in the test before, but they were miles ahead at the point where he came into bat, and then second innings they had a breeze, didn't he? So, difficult to say. I mean, as you say, it's been a bit disappointing in a lot of respects. I mean, there was a point where you thought actually England might win that last test until...
And there was in the second test, I think.
Yeah, until Drew... What's his name? Jarrell came out.
Well, England should have won that last test.
They should have needed... All they needed was 50, 60 more runs in that.
Do you think they got a bit confused in how we approached things, or did India just bowl very well? I had just this... I mean, clearly the moments we lost it, we didn't get them out quick enough. I know that's a blatantly obvious thing to say. When we had their foot on the throat, we didn't press home that advantage. We still had the lead of about 48 runs, I think.
Yeah.
But I just had this feeling in my water, England are going to try and put... They didn't have to score that quickly. Mm. And they seemed to get a little bit confused. I mean, Johnny Bairstow's shot was horrible. Anyone can play bad shots. Anyone can get themselves out. But there seemed to be just too many you would look back on and go, I'm not sure that was my best shot, or I'm not sure that's what I should have played just then. And we just gave ourselves a mountain to climb in terms of getting them out. Because having done so well in the first innings.
This is the kind of conversation that you should be having about your team, of whom you have is a good team with a good captain. You have high expectations, and for good reason. It's so refreshing to be able to talk about England and India in these terms, about, you know, small moments of the game, missed opportunities in certain innings. 4 years ago, this was just, well, where do we start?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Not even remotely. All right, I mean, we did well on one good pitch. And we moaned about the pitches because they made batting a lottery for everyone. Joe Root took 5 wickets. I mean, it was just where did we start? So the progress is there.
Yeah,
I'm grateful to be able to talk about this.
I also say in England's second innings, that I think the turning point actually was that really fucking cracking review by Ashwin on Root, because at that point England were 70 for 2 or something or other. Root had just scored a ton in the first innings. He was looking good in the second,
having not been overbowled.
And you know, they peeled one. It looked like it pitched outside leg. Might well have been going on a hit. Turns out it was in line, just about hitting leg stump. But it was all reds. Root had to go, and I think that kind of threw things a little bit. And a fantastic review by India. Everyone was complaining about it. I don't know why people were complaining about DRS, to be honest.
What's going on? It just really annoys me.
I mean, it's a mathematical thing. Ball tracking is, and prediction, I don't think is a particularly hard thing in mathematics. It's pretty simple mathematics, really. So if you've got enough data, you should be able to do it, and therefore people should just shut up about it, as far as I'm concerned. It is the way it is, and it's the sport.
Absolutely nuts. You've brought in this thing, which I'm going to get my high horse about DRS here a bit. You've brought in this system, which, by any even basic analysis, is vastly better at judging LBWs and lines and prediction and all this stuff. It's much more accurate than any human alternative. And we're all whinging. People, so many whinging about it. I mean, the Indians had a massive whinge about it in South Africa, didn't they, the year before, where Coley was yelling into the stump microphone that the entire thing was being rigged by the broadcaster. Now we've got Michael Vaughan saying there should be cameras in the DRS van.
It's bollocks.
What is going on?
It's nonsense, isn't it? This is
an extraordinary post-truth level of paranoia. It's a very good system. The fact is that people have a really good moan about it when it doesn't give them exactly the decisions they want. That's what one thing that's slightly taken the edge off the Stokes captaincy in this series.
Yeah,
it's gone. We're supposed to be England, a positive, positive, positive. He's whinged a lot about a system which is, apart from anything else, completely egalitarian and fair to both sides. It takes and it gives, and it disappoints and it rewards in completely equal measure. Umpires call bugs me a bit, but I'm sure it bugs you a bit, Nigel.
Yeah, we've certainly debated that at some length.
Yeah, it does.
With other guests.
We're spin bowlers, Nigel. Our view is if the ball is going to hit the stumps, then it's out.
Yes. But it's
a batsman's game, and they want to keep it there.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Michael Vaughan in outrageous claim shocker to get social media clicks. Who'd have thought of it? Yeah. Extraordinary. One thing that absolutely caught my eye, chaps, because you talked about spin bowling, and we have seen Hartley and Shoaib Bashir. So, so callow. I know that's your favourite word. But they've done so well. They talk about learning quickly. And, of course, Brendan McCullum has been very public. He said they need to get more county cricket. They need to play more. But poor old Hartley's going to go back to Lancashire where they've just signed Nathan Lyon. The season starts in 31 days or something. In April, it'll play in October. Big chunk of the summer when the big, nice, nicely sun-baked pitches that would turn a bit are going to be used for the 100 and there won't be any county cricket. Everything's stacked against them. So my question to both of you is why do players like Hartley and Bashir not get the opportunity to go and play in India, to go and play in the Shield over Christmas? At least in Australia you'll get this. There are, if you want to develop spin bowling outside of India, players need to play regularly on pitches that will give them some assistance.
Well, it's not going to be much help in India. There's not going to be much help in Australia either. And plus, they've only got, seven Shield teams or whatever
Nathan
it is.
Nathan Lyon and Shane Warne are not bad examples of players.
But then you look at Australia in between Nathan Lyon and Shane Warne, and how many spinners did they choose who are all shit? Yeah. How many players have they taken out? The Steve O'Keefe of this world and da-da-da-da-da. England, Australia, South Africa don't have a lot of luck when it comes to spinners, and trying to find a good one is hard, trying to find one that sticks. But as you say, this is what I said. I think if you take even inexperienced spinners, if they're pretty good at their craft, and you take them out to India on wickets that are helpful and they know their game, then they will excel. They're not necessarily excel, but they'll certainly look a lot better than they do in England just by dint of the fact that the wickets are helpful. And they can sit on a length or do what they're supposed to do as a spinner to be able to create pressure and therefore get wickets, and don't have that opportunity.
You either engineer wickets, which is very hard to do in the when so much of the county season is played at the wrong time.
Wait a minute. You're starting to sound like this. There's a lot of similarities between the sort of county purists and the Brexiters here. It'll just
well, I can assure you, I'm not a Brexiter. I might.
Well,
be
then I don't get this thing. You know, all this county cricket being played at the wrong time of year, right? Or it's all it's played in April and May. Yes, it always was. Okay, it always was. Even before one day cricket, there was actually county cricket in April and May, and there was the championship.
It has got earlier and later, but generally, I don't disagree with you.
Half the championship season is played on thoroughly unsupportive pitches in April and May, which are, you know, spring pitches, and they support the seamers. This is a good thing for English cricket because it gives our batsmen a huge opportunity to excel in an environment which no one else has apart from the New Zealanders, which is the swinging ball in fresh conditions. And that's one of the reasons why our batters, you know, are good in English conditions. That's what April and May are for. Now, this season, is by the end of the April-May window, exactly half the county championship games will have been played. When they break for the blast, every single county is on seven games. So then they come back, and the second half of the season is, you know, Nigel and I know this, you get to July and you think, right, my turn. And the pitches should be conducive to spin for those second seven games.
And then you have to stop for it for August, which is probably where my brain sits.
Yeah, but they come back and they've got four games in September. The pitches are still the same, but you know, they're worn pitches. Spin's got nothing to do with the weather. Spin's got to do with the ground, and the pitches need to have been played on sufficient number of times to break up. Or if you're Somerset and Essex, you know, you've put your fork in the correct part of the pitch.
You're going back to 2017, excited about it. Yes.
The problem is that whereas a generation or more ago, up until the 90s, the attitude is what the English cricket authorities regard as the correct fourth innings pitch. Now, it used to be that the English cricket authorities felt that a pitch should be at its best on days two and three. Seam on the first day, obviously, all the bulk of the runs going down on two and three, and then on day four, or at the end of day three, as it used to be before the 90s, obviously, that's when the pitch would break up, and you'd ideally have two spinners who bowl, you know, 25, 30 overs each, and it would be really tough to score. So you won the game in the second and third innings. Now the idea of English cricket authorities across the board is that a fourth day pitch sets up a really interesting big fourth innings chase on a flat pitch on the last day. And if someone set 400 in 96 overs on the last day, they've got a really good chance of doing it. So the focus has gone from spin bowling to run chasing on the fourth day. And you get teams that get penalised. Now, you take, there's no reason at all, none at all, why Bashir and Hartley shouldn't play the back end seven games at Lancashire and Somerset. You break it up. Both teams have got a wicketkeeper who can bat in the top six. Both teams have got a little medium pacer in the top six who can bowl some extra overs. So they can both play in the back end of the season. Three proper seam bowlers, two spinners batting from 7 to 11, the wicketkeeper at 6, and they've got a bit of backup seam if they need it. They even complement each other. Bashir breaks the ball back into the right-hander, leaves the opposite.
An off-spinner and a left-armer, haven't you?
So works perfectly.
It does work beautifully together.
If we decided, which we could decide, that the fourth day was about bringing spin into the game, you wouldn't have this, well, only one spinner can play. Well, of course they're not going to play in April and May, but, you know, that was never really the case. Except, you know, maybe uncovered pitches, maybe. But there's no reason we can't solve this problem top down. And then no,
the only reason I was trying to get us to talk to think about is how do you solve it? And the other way, somehow, and I appreciate, you know, the global game and the opportunities that creates in all kinds of different formats and different countries. But surely there is more way. We have Indian cricketers frequently playing in the county championship. We've had them at Middlesex. Fantastic ones too, I might point out. I mean, I look at Pujara at Sussex, who absolutely loves it there. But it doesn't seem to cut the other way. And the opportunity for a Hartley or a Bashir to play more regular cricket, when you look at how the Ranji Trophy is such a breeding ground for successful Indian spinners, the more the game becomes India will be play England, play Australia, and it is kind of focusing it a little bit there. There should be opportunities for English players to play more cricket on subcontinental turning pitches at a club.
Tony, I think your point's a good one about overseas. You know, we don't send a lot of overseas players elsewhere. I'm not sure Ranji in India is the answer. I mean, apart from the fact that the BCCI wouldn't want states leaving out one of their spinners to accommodate one of them. Yeah. Also, remember that a lot of Ranji Trophy pitches are flat as hell because you can win on first innings. So you've got so many Ranji games are decided as first innings where one team scores 700 and the other team scores
600. There was a 250-odd run partnership at numbers 9 and, you know, 10 and right, 9 yeah. the day.
But maybe you saw this on... maybe you saw this on X yesterday, that other podcasting group, Caribbean Cricket Podcast.
Yeah. We know them very well. We know
they know what they're talking about. They know what they're talking about.
The Gorilla alumni.
They tweeted yesterday that there could be a sort of kind of player swap thing in the West Indies Championship, where the English send a spinner over, because, you know, West Indian pitchers are increasingly becoming responsive to spin. And they don't have a lot of spin, like Guyana may be an exception, but they're not flush with spinners over there. And then they send their promising young quicks over in a sort of reciprocal deal.
I think it's a fantastic, it's a wonderful idea. I would love to see infinitely more of that. And actually, believe it or not, you know, as much as it was derided for some in some quarters for some good reasons, the famous High Performance Review had one of its key recommendations was engineer ways that players can get more experience to play more cricket in different
environments.
But it's a fantastic idea.
The Caribbean Cricket Podcast idea is a great idea.
It is.
But still, the best way to deal with that is to have the different environments within the county championship. It's all very well sending the Bashirs and Hartleys and the Rehan Ahmeds off to play in the West Indies Championship, if that could possibly happen. But we still want our batters, don't we, in August and September, facing spin from both ends.
We do, absolutely.
On a good, you know, not a
county. Not August, sadly. That's
There's a championship game in August this year.
One.
But you know, on a good quick turn. Because of course our batters have got to get
used to it as well.
Spin too. So that's my high horse about that.
I don't think we're far apart in what we're saying. Right, last couple of things, because it is going to be drinking up time. Ollie Robinson, what do we think?
Well, Baz protected him, didn't he, and said he tweaked his bat when he was batting.
And that was a very qualified protection in the way I read it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's bloody disappointing because I thought it'd be a lot better than that. But, I mean, you know, bowling at mid-70s is not what you want out of your second seamer only in a game. I mean, he's bowling with Jimmy, who's 40-fucking-1, and he was still managing sort of low 80s, for fuck's sake. And Ollie Robinson at 6 foot whatever, a high release point, releasing it at 75 miles. And apparently he was clocked in the late 60s at one point. That's just not good enough.
There's also Kit there, isn't there? That whisper of off-field antics that are... Or not even antics, but I know he's doing some podcast with his
social Mrs.
influencer girlfriend. And saying things that the management wouldn't be that happy about. There just seems to be a constant air of something going on around him that is kind of frustrating when you know what a talent he has.
I see. Having pontificated for 5 minutes non-stop on spinning pitches, with Robinson, do you know, I just don't... It is a mystery to me. I mean, that kind of character can be harnessed. Remember Swan's video diaries from the 2010-11 Ashes?
Yes.
He was, you know, really enjoying himself in a total non-crickety way off the field. But, you know,
that was always the case on tours.
But that was harnessed, and, you know, he, great bowler, always put in his 100%. With Robinson, I just don't know. But he's got to watch his back, so to speak.
Yeah, I kind of go along with that.
You see Matt Potts on the Lions tour. where after a good start, England were, you know, properly shafted in the second and third first-class games. But Potts took successive sixfers and ended up, I think, taking 20 wickets at about 16, 17 in India.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, there's a man knocking on the door.
Yeah. I mean, we did have
quite a lot of Potts as well. He is a tryer and he does put the effort in. He's not quite quick enough again, but you know, his English pace is never extreme pace, is it, generally, apart from Wood. But Wood's been pretty ineffective. The problem with Wood is he doesn't do anything with the ball except to bowl it really quick.
Can he get a bit of swing?
Well, he gets a bit of reverse when it reverses, but it, you know, if it's not reversing, he doesn't seam it and he doesn't swing it early up.
He's so I've got one last question just on the Ollie subject, just because it's for both of you, and it's kind of a yes no answer in a way. Hadn't played since July. Yes, injury, disappointing, curtailed his Ashes. Would you have taken him on the warm up in Abu Dhabi, or would you have put him into that Lions team to get some cricket under his belt before asking him to perform in key series test cricket?
I'd have taken him on the tour anyway, because
you'd have taken him to Abu Dhabi.
Well, yeah. Because you know, you look at his record, and his record's an average of 22 and 70 odd wickets. You know, he has proved it previously, and I did think he'd be reasonably effective in India, and just proved that.
The question was whether he should have gone to Abu Dhabi or whether he should have gone and played in
the Lions warm-up games.
And I would have put him in the Lions warm-up games. Get some cricket under his belt.
Possibly. But
what about you, Kit? Where would you stand on that one?
Well, he could have played it was a 2-day Lions warm-up game and one first-class Lions game of the three before the Test series. England seem to want to have players who can just switch it on, Darren Goff style.
Yeah.
And then much less interested in bowlers who need to bowl every week, Andy Caddick style. And perhaps Robinson is one of those, and he can only get up to pace by playing, you know, two out of every 3 weeks. But it was clear, wasn't it, with that Lions side that it wasn't a backup side for the team in India. You know, Jennings scores a 100, Bohannon scores 100, and then Brooke goes home and Dan Lawrence flies into India over the heads of the Lions. So that was, you know, that made it clear that this is a development team. This is not a standby team.
I agree. So yeah, that just struck me as a one-off, though. The Ollie Robinson was a weird situation. If you haven't been fit enough to do anything since July, then surely you take that opportunity. But
presumably,
I think it was an opportunity missed.
Presumably, he was asked.
I don't know. Can't answer.
You would think that
you would like to think. Anyway, look, we're out of time. We've rung the last orders bell. We're going to have to send people home. So we'll save New Zealand rather caving, sadly, against Australia.
No worries.
To next time. A reminder, before we say goodbye to Kit, that the book From Lords to the Fjords, the saga of Icelandic cricket, which we've been chatting about for a lot of the time on this podcast, published by Fairfield, available from all good bookstores, a rattling good read, and we would thoroughly recommend it to get on down and get that for yourself. Kit, thank you very much for having
good to see you, my man.
Thank you very much. It's so nice catching up.
Indeed.
It was. We enjoyed it. And episode 69, Bear. 69.
69.
69, mate.
By the end of the year, we'll be over 100. Woo!
We'll get a ton. We won't. We'll probably... One of us will fall over on 93.
Wow. Well,
because we're English. But there we go. We'll run each other out.
Yes.
We will see you next time in the Bishop and Bear. Thank you all for your company. Thank you, Kit, for your company. See you next time.
Bye. And don't forget, you can Patreon us at patreon.com/gorillacricket if you really like us, because that's always helpful. Gorilla
Cricket. Revolutionary cricket commentary.
Sports Social Podcast Network.